The following presentation was recorded at the 2000 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Don't push the buttons. Learn where his buttons are. Don't do things that cause flare-ups. Brothers and sisters learn very well how to push their brothers and sisters' buttons to get a rise out of them. And so as a teacher, it behooves you to know what will frustrate or anger your student. Don't provoke them to wrath. Don't do that unnecessarily and then end up with disciplining because he got angry. There's no excuse for that. He enjoys humor. And so teach him what to laugh at and what not to laugh at. There are some things that might seem funny that you shouldn't laugh at. It's not appropriate to laugh at. And there's much that happens that is humor. Humor has to do with, humor is related to lamentation, actually. you can't lament unless you see the gap between what ought to be and what is. And you lament that. You can sorrow, mourn over. And humor also, humor sees, if you take yourself too seriously, you know, you get a pretty long face. And if you can't laugh at yourself, laugh about yourself, why, you really have a pretty hard time in life. And so you ought to be able to, if you see yourself maybe getting lazy or upset, kind of chuckle at yourself and say, there you go again, another round. Now, humor has to do with seeing discrepancies, plays on words, or irony, dramatic irony, between seeing what is and what the other person realizes, and this person doesn't realize who's following him. The hunter's walking through the woods and the deer is following him through the woods. Now, that's supposed to be funny, if you think of it. People, you do need to be able to see it. But let me hasten to say that don't try to be funny when you teach. If there's anything that's not funny, it's the teacher who tries to be funny and tries to make jokes. It will happen. It should happen naturally. It'll come out in the process as you study and as things happen. There are fascinating things happen. Be of good cheer. His development may seem latent. That is, it might seem like you pretty well arrived. These children they're behaving well. They sing well and they're cheerful and so on, but don't be tricked. There's a lot of changes going on inside. It's almost like a latent change, like a metamorphosis going on inside. And a few years hence, in grade 7 and 8, then this is going to come out. It's almost like they're regrouping. And this is a time to really, if they're doing well, bless God and push, strike while the iron is hot. If they're receptive, hey, give them what you can. That's the time that you really want to then teach them about the character qualities, being cheerful and kind and loving and thoughtful. Drive these things home while they're listening. If you think everything's just fine, and then 2 or 3 years down the road, it turns out that they aren't fine, and then you start to try to teach them about these things, it may be too late or it may be much harder. So continue to teach them these character qualities. Excellent time for teaching character. And then spiritually, his religion is not emotional. He does not have the feelings about it, typically, that we adults may have. But he does see his need for Christ. He sees it in a very practical way. And you can simply point to him very simply that Jesus loves you. He will help you. He can help you with your studies. He can help you to get along with your friends. It can be a very practical, down-to-earth way. And that's really the way it's supposed to be for us. He feels a responsibility for his sins, that is for what he has done wrong. Probably he feels more responsibility for what he's done wrong than for who he is. And so he can find forgiveness for his sins and still have that good cheer and innocence without being burdened with being a bad person. His questions about Christianity are often very, very practical. How does this happen? And how does God do this? And so you have to kind of answer them on that level. He needs encouragement. He loves stories. And again, as you teach these children, teach them to bring out their abilities. Try to understand them. and work with what you have. If they're going in this direction, or it's a good direction, push in that direction. If you're pushing somebody on the swing, there's a time to push. There's a time to push. And a time that it's not very effective to push. And so, if these people, as you see, with God's wisdom, you can strike while the iron is hot. You can work in the direction. You can encourage them in the right way at the right time. And your teaching is to bring out abilities that they have and not to point out their deficiencies. All right, we will take a break till about 5 after 11. Then let's meet here again. Echo. Now listen carefully so that you get the echo. I asked of Echo the other day, whose words are often few and funny, what to a novice she could say of courtship, love, and matrimony. Quoth Echo plainly, matrimony. Whom should I marry? Should it be a dashing damsel, gay and pert? A pattern of inconstancy, of selfish, mercenary flirt? Quoth Echo sharply, nary flirt. What if, aweary of the strife that long has lured the dear deceiver, she promised to amend her life and sin no more? Can I believe her? Quoth Echo very promptly, leave her. But if some maiden with a heart on me should venture to bestow it, pray, should I act the wiser part, to take the treasure or forego it? Quoth Echo with decision, go it. But what if, seemingly afraid to bind her fate in Hymen's fetter, she vow she means to die a maid in answer to my loving letter? Quoth Echo rather coolly, let her. What if, in spite of her disdain, I find my heart entwined about with Cupid's dear delicious chain so closely that I can't get out? Quoth Echo laughingly, get out. But if some maid with beauty blessed, as pure and fair as heaven can make her, will share my labor and my rest till envious death shall overtake her, quoth Echo, Sato Bose, take her. There are all kinds of poems and all kinds of stories. What I want to do to start this session is look at the back of the sheet I gave you yesterday on planning the lesson. The back of the sheet says how Jesus established contact with people. Now, if anyone wasn't here yesterday, I do have yesterday's handouts. Who does not have, never got one? All right, you can come up and help yourself. They're up here. If you want them badly enough, well, you can come for them. There's three of them up here. Now, I talked yesterday about the importance of making contact. You can get the attention, but if you don't make contact, all you have is the attention, and the person might be watching you go through your strange motions, being intrigued by the shirt that you're wearing or some other thing, and not really be in contact with you. And we look briefly at the first four, and now we'll pick up with number five. He used the name effectively. Jesus said sometimes, he says, thou art Peter. Zacchaeus, come down. Martha, Martha, you're encumbered about the cares. Lazarus, come forth. Mary, he said in the garden. Simon, son of Jonas. Many times he used the first name very effectively. And you can do that without any effort when you're teaching in a class, if you know the names. Why, you can refer, if you're talking about distances, the distance from Jane's house to Susie's house, and you can talk about if Bill's father digs a hole and wants to fill it with dirt. And not overdoing it, but just using the name occasionally. There's nothing so special and precious to you as your first name, is there? And to have the name used occasionally. He also stimulated curiosity. He led the people on. Come and see. Come and see. You must be born again. Curious questions, stimulating questions. You must be born again. You shall see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. Jesus said things that offered them far more than they were expecting. It intrigued them. And so you can refer to an upcoming story or lesson and say, our lesson tomorrow. Now, you can ask, how many of you ever ran away from somebody who was chasing you? By the way, whoever did that, somebody was chasing you, ran away. Whoever, maybe in playing a game, you went the whole way around the school building to get away from somebody. Well, yes, they did. Now, tomorrow's lesson in history involves a man who also ran away. But guess what he did? He went the whole way around the world to get away from somebody in a ship. Who was it? Well, you'll find that out tomorrow. If you don't know, ask me at lunchtime. It's in American history. All right. Then there's another story. We're going to read a story about a boy who thought he had outrun a dog until something happened. And did you know that something just went through your head in the last minute? Right down to the roof, through your head, and out through you, and down through the earth, and out the other side of the earth. Did you know it's happening right now? Well, that introduces our subject, cosmic rays. Or you can talk about something too small to hold. There are ways that you can introduce the subject without being cute, by being honest, straightforward. It really is the case. Jesus used his eyes effectively. He observed Andrew. He gazed, it says sometimes, upon them. He saw. He lifted up his eyes on his disciples. And he looked up to his Father. And he looked round about upon them. He turned and looked upon Peter as he taught. Your eyes communicate very, very much. I saw a teacher demonstrate one time three kinds of eye contact. It's kind of fun to do. And an inexperienced teacher's, an inexperienced speaker will often begin by, maybe you'll stare at the wall. At least that's better than looking back in your paper. If you teach back into your book, it already is in the book. You don't have to put it back in. And so at least you can look up from the book. Well, then you look at the wall. That's one better. Well, then the first thing you master is the scanning method. And as you speak, at least you look around at everybody. And I won't take the time to do this, but in one class, they had us all put our hands up and said, as soon as you know that I looked at you in the eyes, you drop your hand. And you feel like you're zapping them down. And you try to get the hands down as fast as you can. Well, that's the scanning method. And then the other approach is to pause just a moment at one person's eyes. And that person knows that you're looking at them. Right? He knows it. And you're talking along, and he knows that you're looking at him for a few moments. And depending on the size of the group, you can't do that with everybody, but it happens occasionally that you know that that person hit your eyes or locked eyes with you for maybe just a split second. Now, the third way is more fascinating yet, that you can do occasionally. Do you know that it's more fascinating to eavesdrop than it is to hear somebody talking to you directly? And so, on occasion, if you're explaining something, why, you can actually lock in on one person and just talk to that person. And you tell Matthew how this thing works. And in fact, say, now, you've seen this happen already, haven't you? And you actually end up having a little conversation with this person. He says, yeah, I know about that. And the rest of the class, they're sitting there and they're kind of looking up at you and looking back at him, up at you and back at him. What's going on here? Well, all right, anyway, eye contact it has to be natural. You don't feign it, don't put it on, but cultivate that looking in the eyes. Jesus asked effective questions that carried forward his purpose, came to the heart of the matter. Yes, the pool of Bethesda, there was a man there. He said, would you like to be made whole? Would I? Yes, I would. He came right to the heart of the matter. And he asked, when he talked to Peter, he drove right at the heart of it. Do you love me? Do you love me? And his questions were directly purposeful to carrying forward what he wanted to do. And so, again, you can ask questions like that. Would you like me to show you how to do that? Do you know where the problem is? Do you know what the difficulty is here? He gave direct, purposeful, plausible tasks. Listen to some of these. Go and sell what you have. Was that direct instruction or that direct connection, direct instruction? Yes. Could he do it? Yes. Would he do it? Well, that's a different story. Go show yourself to the priests. Go tell what great thing the Lord has done for you. Don't tell anybody about this. Well, Jesus often followed his contact with some action. So when you have contact with a child, give him steps for a problem. Give him something he can do. Do this first and then do that. All right, you have this set up wrong. I want you to set it up this way. I'll be back later. And then I'll help you if you still need help. Show them what to do. Give them direct steps. Number 10, he showed understanding of character. He showed empathy. He pointed out the good, but he also dealt with the bad. And so when people came to him and he saw Nathanael, for example, he said, oh, here's an Israelite with no guile. Zacchaeus, come down. I must come to your house. Then he saw a widow over there. He understood exactly all about the widow. He said, do you see what she's doing? She's cast in more than anybody else has. He was criticized for eating with publicans and sinners. Now, put yourself in the host's place here. He says, they that are whole need no physician, but they that are sick. Now, the implication was here that the host was in with the sick crowd. But, I mean, it was a pretty direct statement. All right. He accepted people at their best, but he led them onward. And by the way, there's no acceptance of the people as they are, there's no relationship, and you don't get much accomplished. And he accepted and had a relationship with others that affected both that group and intrigued others. One of you yesterday asked the question, the problem-solving group, what about this if you have people who don't like each other, don't get along? Well, I tell you, your relationship that you cultivate with both parties there will affect the other party. The way you treat this one will affect what they think of you and them, and the way you treat them will affect what they think of you and them. And so Jesus, really, he just violated people's categories by, oh, he cared about the poor. But guess what? He cared about the Pharisees. He cared about the rich. He cared about the Syrophoenician woman. He cared about everybody. He didn't take any sides. They were fascinated by the way he treated them, but they were also fascinated by the way he treated other people. And so, the whole room, your whole room, will be affected by how you deal with other people. Perhaps more than by the way you deal with them. They will see how you deal with others. They will see how you deal with the bright student, with the slow student, with the troublemaker, with the average quiet student who, quote, doesn't need any attention. Does that person get any attention? Or do you have to act out in order to get attention? They will see, and they will notice that. So you need to care about everybody. So you need to discipline both the ruly and the unruly. Yes, the ruly need as much discipline as anybody else. That is, we work within the structures, we do our work, and everybody follows the rules. You want to love the popular and the unpopular. You want to greet the boys and the girls. Regardless, if you're a man teacher, you greet everybody. Woman teacher, you greet everybody. And don't be afraid to commend anyone before all. Deal with them honestly, straightforwardly. Number 11, he requested natural favors. It's wonderful to have the opportunity to ask someone to do something for you occasionally that you really would like done. Jesus asked for a drink, the woman at the well. And so something as simple as, would you hand that to me? Could you reach that? And a simple little request that a child can do something for you. Would you bring the book here or would you go get that? And say thank you. Don't forget to say thank you to your students, honestly, when there's something to thank them for. He followed up on others' contact. That is, example, Nicodemus came to him and said, Master, we know you're a teacher. And he took advantage of that contact already made. Nicodemus took the initiative to come to him. Jesus capitalized on that and said, you can't see the kingdom without the new birth. And he went into a discussion there. So he didn't rebuke Nicodemus. He didn't make him back off or wish that he wouldn't have come. But he led him forward in a shocking way that opened his eyes, really stretched him. And so you can spice up history class, for example, with an unusual little tidbit that you know. Who knows? What do you know about Balboa? Balboa, B-A-L-B-O-A. What does that name mean to anybody? What did he do? Yes. He was an explorer, and he's remembered for? Yeah, Pacific Ocean. Did you know he was a pig farmer? Mm-hmm. Pig farmer. All right. Why do you laugh? Everybody has to make his living somehow. Well, anyway, there are, in the context of learning, there are some, sometimes the surprising mundane can shock you, and other times the big thing can shock you. Let's go to 13. False contact, yes, with directness. They came to him and said, "Oh, master, we know you're true. We know you're for God. You don't care for any man. Hey, there's something coming here." He saw through this. It's unlawful to give tribute. And he responded. He didn't even talk about the tribute. He said, "Why are you tempting me?" He knew exactly where they were coming from. And the result was they marveled. Another standing by said, "Beware." Now, when somebody comes to you with a question, suppose somebody walks, a student comes to you and says that, "Must everybody here in the school obey the rules?" How do you answer that question? Why do you ask? there is something behind that. They don't really want to know whether everybody must obey the rules. They have something up the sleeve. Maybe somebody comes with a complaint or with he's a tattler. And you might respond with, you would be kind of happy to see that person punished, wouldn't you? If it's truly a tattler. Oh, well, I didn't come to talk to you about how I would feel. There's a problem here. And somebody might come with something that's just another complaint, and you come right back, "Well, you're complaining again. You're complaining again today. Yesterday it was that, today it's this. I wonder what it will be tomorrow." Now, you don't do that in a belittling way, but directly. I guess if you play cards, there's an expression you call a spade a spade. I'm not familiar with cards, but call sin, sin. Name it for what it is. That's a complaint. So respond with directness. When a student, and it's amazing, you have no idea how students may be scared of you. I mean, you're just you. I grew up with myself, and I know myself, so I'm not scared of myself. I'm just me. My opinions are just my thoughts. But some people are almost petrified to come and ask you something, and so they'll send somebody else. Say, "Could so-and-so do this?" And you say, "Oh, well, that may be. Why don't you tell her to come and ask?" If she wants to know that, she can ask. So know where they're coming from. All right, 14, Jesus did his work well and diligently. He healed, he taught, he went about doing good, the Bible says. Doing work well gives you opportunity for contact. And so students need to see you doing your work well. When you do your work well, that encourages them to do their work well. He taught things of interest. He capitalized on what they were already thinking about. What they were already thinking about. One day they were thinking about, "Who's the greatest? Me or you? Who's the greatest?" Well, Jesus, he didn't say, "Hey, come on, get these thoughts out of your mind. We have something important to think about." But he worked with that. He said, "Who is the greatest?" Well, he had their attention. He had contact because they were already facing the question. Who is the greatest? The person who teaches? No. A child? Oh. And so all of a sudden he took what they were already thinking and took them somewhere with that. The two men on the road to Emmaus, he walks up to them and says, excuse me, what's the subject of the conversation here? And, well, about the things that have been going. Well, what things? And he drew it out of them. And he knew very well what things, but he drew it out of them. And then he worked with that. He picked up with what they were thinking about and went with it. And so you can make application, things of interest. In science class, you can make applications to the things boys think about, cars, machinery, their forces, energy, and so on. You can talk about recipes and geography. If you're talking about other parts of the world, well, you could plan an imaginary trip. And where will our stops be? What clothing will we need to take along? What kind of money will we need? Will we need francs? Will we need marks? What will we need? How much money? Do we need more marks than we do dollars? We're going to have to do some checking here if we're going to take this trip. And that trip that you plan around the world could be the controlling theme or image for a whole month or whatever. In order to plan this trip, you would have to think about languages and transportation and money and whatever. He also told stories. One of the metaphors that would be very useful and powerful would be to say that the teachers are the storytellers. Are you full of stories? Are you full of stories? And find a story in history, in current events. I love the example when the man said to Jesus, well, who is my neighbor? And Jesus responded with the dictionary definition, right? No, he told a story. And the man understood very well. Think of stories that illustrate things. He also used spur of the moment, what's often called the teachable moment. When he passed by Zacchaeus' tree, there was a perfect time to do what he wanted to do in Zacchaeus' house. Because, after all, Zacchaeus was really interested. And that when you accept the moment, it shows you your character comes out in a different way. The person doesn't feel like you're just planning something for him, but catching the teachable moment really, if you're having class and a hot air balloon lands out in front of your school, why, you say, we've got to get these sentences diagram. you're missing a point. We had that happen once, that hot air balloon landed. And it happened to be a handicap day, by the way, when we were all either in wheelchairs or crutches or arms and slings. We emanated from the school. The balloon came down. We came limping. Limping out. And they wondered what kind of a school this was. And anyway, but excellent time. You don't need to dissect that to death, but it's an excellent time to talk about hot air balloons and how they work and what is this thing anyway and so on. Use a teachable moment. And number 18, live up to expectations in proper ways. There are certain things expected of a teacher. They expect you to take charge. Take charge. They don't expect you to act like one of them. Don't try to. Jesus did, in fact, ride on a donkey when it was time for him to ride into Jerusalem. He did. That was the thing for a king to do. And when it was time to teach, he sat down. That's interesting. We're really doing this backwards. You should be standing and sitting, but anyway, he did live up to expectations. And also, he had compassion. He moved, he acted numerous times from compassion. It was his motive. A desire to help. He wanted to help. He saw fragmentary lives. He saw fragmentary thoughts. And that's what drives a teacher. You see disconnected thoughts here in a child's mind, and you try to bring these things together. You try to integrate the thoughts to get him thinking straight. No, this is how you look at it. This is how it works. This is how it is. And you try to put things together. You try to help. And in order to have compassion, you must want to help. You must have a heart of compassion. You must want to help. A very powerful question you can ask. This is another list of metaphors you can do. And that is, what moves me? Fascinating little personal Bible study you can do. Take a concordance and you find the word move, and you just go through the Bible and find out what moved people to do things. All kinds of things motivate people, move people. Some people are moved with envy. Some people are moved with fear. And Jesus, at several times, was moved with compassion. And when teachers are moved, most teachers are not moved by money because there isn't enough to move them into the classroom. So some have moved out of the classroom for money. But there's something that moves you into that position. And last of all, he wanted contact. Jesus, he couldn't keep away from people. He went about doing good. He lamented over Jerusalem when he was rejected. And at the end, he said, with desire, I have desired to eat this Passover with you. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. We must want to interact. Compassion isn't just a vague, wishy feeling. It actually takes practical flesh and blood things. It shows up in terms of helping somebody figure out how to solve a problem, helping him figure out how to look up a word in the dictionary. It's very practical. It takes form in ways that are so obvious that sometimes we do not see them or think about them. Any comments or questions? Suggestions? What I'd like to do is, in thinking about planning a lesson, we talked about having a somehow knowing a purpose, knowing a goal, and somehow there has to be something to cohere, something to make your lesson stick together. You have to have some direction that you want to go. Otherwise, you just kind of roam here, roam there, talk about this or talk about that. Let me give you one example. I pulled out of a file here a couple of overheads. This is from using conjunction with a sixth grade science book with a chapter on a couple of chapters, actually. And this does not cover the whole chapter, but just look at this. Don't try to copy it down. A chapter on the sun. I talked about knowing what you want to teach. And here is simply a list. These are some kinds of facts that when I taught this chapter, they were taken from the chapter. These were kind of the basic facts I wanted them to know. That the sun is a million times larger than the earth. How far away it is. At 100 miles per hour nonstop, it would take 106 years to get there. It's the center of the solar system, the closest star, and so on down the list. And so these 10 facts, these 10 things provided material for a couple days. And they read it, and we talk about it, and you try somehow to give them an appreciation for the size of the sun. And what I want them to know about the sun, what I want them to be able to think about. When you think about the sun, your thoughts should have content, just like the boy who thought about problem number 6. It's hard. Well, no, he should be able to think specifically. So if you think about the sun, it shouldn't just be, it's a big thought thing in the sky. But if you study it, it's wonderful to be able to articulate some individual things about this. So tell me about, there are sunspots. You don't need to know much about them, but there are darker areas on the sun. They move across the sun. Actually, the sun rotates, and there are such things as solar flares and prominences. They will forget some of these things, maybe most of them, and that's okay. You haven't failed if they forget them. But they are going to have an appreciation for the sun, and they're going to know that there's some things there, and it wouldn't take long to look them up. It's fascinating that the sun is a gas, and theoretically you could float in one side and out the other because there's nothing to keep you from doing that. And so, well, I won't talk more about the sun. I could talk all morning about that too. That's interesting. A few things. This is one another teacher worked up on stars. This was again the 5th and 6th grade class taught together, and a few basic things to know about stars, dwarfs, giants, supergiants, and so on. Now, given a you decide what things, and of course, if you're using a test put out by the publisher, you know, different publishers have different philosophies. Some publishers will give you a test, and the work is done for you. And that's fine. Now, there's just one catch. You need to make sure that you teach what the test tests before you give the test. If you don't teach what the test tests, then it's not really a test. It's partly whatever else you can call it, but it doesn't test what you taught. And so you will always find, if you use somebody else's test, there will be at least be one or two questions on there that you think are kind of, well, that question really wouldn't have to be on there. I don't think that's very important for them to remember that. But this ought to be on the test. And so some publishers will not give you tests for that very reason. They'll say you ought to make your own because you are going to decide what kinds of things are important there, and you're going to teach towards that and then test for that. Now, then I talked about this list of facts, though, is a list of facts. And my friends, you could put that list. Here's another one on energy. We get the definition, which is a limited definition if you study physics, but nevertheless. And then we have some different kinds of energy, and we have uses of solar energy, and we have a variety of kinds of fossil fuels and so on. Now, you could give that list. They could copy it down in their notebooks, and they could then all answer the questions correctly on the test. And that's okay to a certain extent. They do need to know some terms. However, what you want to do is have them take those faults that you present. And you want to do like you do with the pen. You want to take that thing apart and handle it and think about it. Oh, okay. So the sun is a million times as large as the earth. What about that? Oh, it's massive. It's big. That means that doesn't mean it's that much bigger across, but it means you can put that many inside it. And so, oh, it's that far away. 106 years to get there nonstop at 100 miles. That's far away. But the light, it only takes 8 minutes for the light to get here from the sun. That is far away. And you start developing some, and all along the way, you realize, and God made that? And the fact is that what is as amazing about this, what's more amazing than creation? We talk about creation in Genesis 1, and that's wonderful. But what's more powerful, what's more fascinating, is that it's ongoing in the sense that in Him all things consist. Everything is held together by Christ. And so the fact that the Son is still operating, it was not made like a grandfather clock, Deus notwithstanding. It was not just made and then it continues operating. But it's the ongoing work of God day by day that keeps that sun and the stars functioning. You want to see God at work? Go outside and look at the clouds. Yes, and I don't just mean that poetically either. It's true metaphorically, but it's also true in a very real way that he is at work there day by day. Now, let me give you an example of another kind of a thing with a poem that has a there's some questions here for there we go. Nobility. I'll put the poem on here and read through it. Who's ever memorized this? Nobody? All right. Let's read it together. Slowly. True worth is in being, not seeming, in doing each day that goes by some little good, not in dreaming of great things to do by and by. For whatever men say in their blindness and spite of the fancies of youth, there's nothing so kingly as kindness and nothing so royal as truth. We get back our meat as we measure. We cannot do wrong and feel right, nor can we give pain and gain pleasure, for justice avenges each slight. The air for the wing of the sparrow, the bush for the robin and wren, but always the path that is narrow and straight for the children of men. We cannot make bargains for blisses, nor catch them like fishes in nets, and sometimes the thing our life misses helps more than the thing which it gets. For good lieth not in pursuing, nor gaining of great or of small, but just in the doing, and doing as we would be done by is all. Now, what do you do with a poem if it's in your curriculum? There are various things you can do with it. We could, well, and what I'm going to do with this one is the focus here And this is a good one to memorize, by the way, but we also, let's see whether we can understand this. I'd like you to, there are three stanzas, and each stanza has eight lines. Now, I'm going to give you a statement, and you tell me whether it's true or false, and if it's true, tell me how you know it's true by the stanza and the line. Here's the first one. It's what you are that counts. It's what you are that counts. Does the poem say that or doesn't it? I see some head shaking. Where does it say it?
First line, true or
in being, right. Now, this is one kind of thing that you can do with in a lesson, whether it's history, reading, poem, whatever. It's one thing to know that something is true, just because something is true. For example, God is love. That's true, right? Does the poem say that? No, the poem doesn't say that. The poem doesn't say he is in love either. It just does not address the subject. So just because something is true doesn't mean that this text deals with that subject. Also, oftentimes we can read something and know that it's in there, know it said it, but you try to find it in there, and we don't have to do it all the time, but you need to be able to do it. You ought to be able to go to something that you read and say, right here it says it, black on white, if it's that kind of a thing. All right, here's the next one. The fancies of youth are kingly and royal. True or false? And where does it say? It's false. Why would anybody say it is true? Possibly. Mm-hmm. All right. Yes. It's amazing how children can read something and they see some words in the question and say, oh yeah, kingly and royal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the poem talked about being kingly and royal. They check it. Well, no, excuse me, what did it say about kingly and royal? What did it say? It said, there's nothing so kingly and royal as truth. That's especially true in poems. Often the word order is turned around a bit. And you see, and it's interesting, in spite of the fancies of youth, there's, you know, it's associated here. They say, wait a minute. It talks about it right here in the last three lines, the fancies of youth and kingly and royal. All right, let's go on. What we don't get helps us more sometimes than what we do get. Now here, true. Where does it say it? Well, you did one before. Let's have somebody else. You had the last one, didn't you? Or was it you? Oh, excuse me. Go ahead.
So something, sometimes the thing I like miss is that it's
more than the thing. Right. Right here. Sometimes it misses off more than the thing which it gets. And it doesn't say in those same words, but it says the idea. We cannot give pain without pleasure. True or false? Or does it say it or doesn't it? That's really the question. We cannot give pain without pleasure.
False.
That's false. What does it say? Right. And it's amazing how a child may slip over that one and you see, miss the little word. There's a big difference between giving pain. Happiness cannot be bought cheaply. Does it say it? And if it does, where? Where? Mm-hmm. Yes. Right here. That's a hard one to understand. And you challenge the student. This is taken from a 7th or 8th grade book. And to think that one through, we cannot make bargains for blisses. It's correct. You cannot go searching successfully for happiness. True or false? And does it say it or doesn't it? And if it does, where does it say it? You cannot go searching successfully for happiness. Does the poem address that subject at all? False? You think it's true? Hey, this is getting interesting. We should have some disagreement here, otherwise, if everybody just says yes, we're not learning anything. Back here somewhere? Michael?
I say it's true.
You say it's true. Where? Where does it say that? Okay. By the way, I shouldn't be saying true and false. The real question is, does the poem say it or doesn't it say it? All right. Do you see that anywhere else? Yes. That's correct. And going on to the good lies not in pursuing. See, we're talking about getting blisses here. And it doesn't lie in pursuing or gaining, doing. And doing as we would be done by. In other words, being right, doing right. That's what brings the joy. We earn our living by measuring. We earn our living by measuring. Does it say that? Matthew? It addresses a subject. What? Yeah. What is that? Is it saying that we earn our living by measuring, do you suppose? I don't think so. No. One of the things, and when you read a poem, if you really want your children to understand a poem sometime, you've got to work with it to make sure they understand it. And you don't want to be tricky about it, but think through it. And it's amazing how we, what is, see, this is an unusual word here, me. And you think how they will think. And you work with how they will think. And let's go to another one. There is really nothing like a bargain. There is really nothing like a bargain. Does the poem address the subject? Does it say that? This is nothing as king as kindness, and nothing so royal as truth. Okay. Does that say that there is no bargain? Or
well, your question was what?
My question is, there is really nothing like a bargain.
Well, I'm saying the poem is saying there's nothing like kindness.
Yeah, that's right, it is. That's the theme of the poem. Okay, right. The poem doesn't address it. The poem does not address that. You're correct. We can't make bargains for blisses, but that's not saying there are no bargains or the bargains are bad. There might be. Maybe they are bad, but the poem does not deal with the subject. All right, now, that is a kind of thing to do. Now, let me tell you, though, that I think probably, and I could talk for the rest of the day about poetry, too. I think probably the problem, one of the biggest problems that we can create with poems is dissecting them to death. Finding out how they rhyme, what the rhythm is, and so on. Isn't that what you like to do when you sit down to a Thanksgiving meal and you want to enjoy the meal? Don't you first, or at least at some point, don't you talk about the ingredients of each recipe, the spices you put into the filling, what kind of bread you used, whether it was made with whole wheat flour or white flour, and how the chicken was raised, how it was dressed, and the ingredients of the cake. Doesn't that add to the enjoyment of Thanksgiving dinner to do that? Do you do it before you eat the meal or after you eat the meal, or while you're eating the meal? Why do I see those faces? What am I saying? What am I suggesting? Yes.
Ruin the meal by doing that, you can also ruin
That's correct. That's correct. Now, there is a time for what I did here. There's a time for all things. However, and there's a time for knowing recipes too. There's a time for that. But most, we eat most of our meals without analyzing them. And we enjoy them. And by the way, we live on them too. The food is in fact digested and changed into flesh and blood, and you are what you ate. I'm suggesting that most of the things that you read, and a child should, most of the poems that are presented to him and the stories that he reads should not, that percentage should not be dissected and analyzed to death. Let me read you another poem. This is called Christ in Flanders. Flanders Fields refers to the grave, the cemetery over in Europe, where there are many soldiers buried, I believe, from World War I. There are rows and rows of white stones. And the people are speaking here. We had forgotten you, or very nearly. You did not seem to touch us very nearly. Of course, we thought about you now and then, especially in any time of trouble. We knew that you were good in time of trouble, but we were very ordinary men. And there were always other things to think of. There's lots of things a man has got to think of. His work, his home, his pleasure, and his wife. And so, we only thought of you on Sunday. Sometimes, perhaps, not even on a Sunday, because there's always lots to fill one's life. And all the while, in street or lane or byway, in country lane, in city street or byway, you walked among us and we did not see. Your feet were bleeding as you walked our pavements. How did we miss your footprints on our pavements? Can there be other folk as blind as we? And I'll stop there. I'll read one more. It's called We Are Seven. These are somewhat similar in a way. A simple child that lightly draws its breath and feels its life in every limb, what should it know of death? I met a little cottage girl. She was 8 years old, she said. Her hair was thick with many a curl that clustered round her head. She had a rustic woodland air, and she was wildly clad. Her eyes were fair and very fair. Her beauty made me glad. Sisters and brothers, little maid, how many may you be? How many? Seven in all, she said, and wondering, looked at me. And where are they, I pray you tell? She answered, Seven are we, and two of us at Conway dwell, and two are gone to sea. Two of us in the churchyard lie, my sister and my brother, and in the churchyard cottage I dwell near them with my mother. You say that two at Conway dwell, and two are gone to sea, yet you are seven. I pray you tell, sweet maid, how this may be. Then did the little maid reply, Seven boys and girls are we. Two of us in the churchyard lie beneath the churchyard tree. You run about, my little maid. Your limbs, they are alive. If two are in the churchyard laid, then ye are only five. Their graves are green, they may be seen, the little maid replied. 12 steps or more from my mother's door, and they are side by side. My stockings there I often knit, my kerchief there I hem, and there upon the ground I sit and sing a song to them. And often after sunset, sir, when it is light and fair, I take my little porringer and eat my supper there. The first that died was Sister Jane. In bed she moaning lay, till God released her from her pain, and then she went away. So in the churchyard she was laid, and when the grass was dry, together round her grave we played, my brother John and I. And when the ground was white with snow, and I could run and slide, my brother John was forced to go, and he lies by her side. How many are you then? Said I. If they two are in heaven. Quick, was the little maid's reply, O master, we are seven. But they are dead. Those two are dead. Their spirits are in heaven. 'Twas throwing words away, for still the little maid would have her will, and said, Nay, we are seven. Now, there are times when it almost seems profane to get out the scalpel and start dissecting something. You, in the story of the Good Samaritan, notice they did not take it apart. It did its job. And there are times for doing what we did here, but most of the poetry a child hears, most in number of times, if he hears 100 poems in the year, you don't want to dissect most of them. That is not how you learn poetry. That's not how you appreciate poetry or stories for that matter. It's one thing to develop a comprehension skill, and it's another thing to work at that. Let me point out that in reading, we all are involved in teaching reading. Teaching reading involves four major kinds of activities. And the first one, which we usually start on, is decoding, which simply means being able to look at a page of print. And when you look at that page of print, you're able to say out loud correctly the same words that the person had in mind when he made the scribbles in the paper. And that's kind of magic. And it's exciting for a child to be able to do that. And that's a step. Another major category is comprehension and everything that goes with it. And that's a big subject. All right, so you can read. Now, do you understand? Do you make sense out of what you read? And a third major thing is, I should say, oral reading. I wrote read aloud. That means the ability to take something and read it aloud in such a way that you read it with expression and show understanding of it and can share it with another. And that is a different kind of skill entirely from comprehension. Now, there's a fourth area of reading that is the most important. And it's one that we need to give careful thought as to what we do. It's possible to produce children, not produce, to teach children in such a way that they're excellent readers. They can read with good expression, and they can understand anything they read. But what's the question? Some of you heard me say this before, so you know what the question is. What do we wonder when they get out of school? And that is, do they read? Do they read? We have many people. If you produce students who are literate, if they're not illiterate, that means they can read and write. But we produce many people who are illiterate. That is, reading and writing has nothing to do with their lives. And if you teach children, they go through your school and have excellent ability to read and write, but they could even not be interested. They could. It's possible they might not see any value in reading, or more, worse yet, they might even not want to read. If reading poetry to them means figuring out rhyme schemes and how many syllables in per line, whether it's iambic or trochaic, what kind of verse it is, or reading a story or a book means trying to figure out who the character is and who did what, if that's all they think of, well, why would you pick something up and read it? Because I don't want to do that all the time. Somehow, and this is the big question, somehow there is so much, and don't get me wrong, there are many things to do in life besides read, many more important things to do in life. And there are people who really are not interested in reading because they are doers, and that's fine. But I'm talking about the by and large, people who could otherwise be very interested readers and could learn and expand and grow in their world by reading, and they are not introduced to what there is out there to read. And so I'll close on that note and pick up more on that tomorrow. But what are you and I doing in our classrooms to cultivate the children's mind, spirit, interest in such a way that, in fact, he does read and is interested in doing some reading? Thank you. It's time for lunch. After lunch, we have our afternoon schedules again.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.